They thought she was just a pretty distraction. A secret. A body to buy, a voice to silence. But behind the silk sheets and expensive wine, she was recording everything. Two powerful political rivals, both married, both corrupt, used her to wage a private war. What they didn't know, she was playing them both. And when she found the hidden cameras in her bedroom, she didn't run. She watched them back. Secrets. Surveillance. Scandal. One woman, one setup, and two careers destroyed. This is the story of the woman they called the Second Mistress. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you The Second Mistress. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, Velvet Silence. They say when you walk into a place built on secrets, you should feel the weight of every whisper that's ever died there. And yet, when men step into my condo, this soundproof, scent-controlled, aesthetically perfect cocoon, they don't feel burdened. They feel invincible. But that's only because I let them. My name isn't important, and it never will be. Not to them. Not to the world. Not even to me. I exist between identities, between fantasies, between marriages and scandals and hand-stitched suits that reek of aftershave and arrogance. I live in the velvet silence of discretion, where nothing is remembered and everything is paid for. They call me the Second Mistress. Not the first. Never the first. That role demands love, loyalty, vulnerability. I offer none of those things. What I offer is precision, emotional detachment wrapped in satin and stilettos, a curated experience with just enough realism to make a man feel like a god, before sending him back to his chaos with lips swollen from lies and a heartbeat slightly out of rhythm. My sanctuary is a penthouse hidden behind a wall of anonymity. No building name on the exterior. No doorman. The elevator is accessible only by a coded keycard, changed weekly, never reused. The hallway lights adjust to skin tone and mood. The walls absorb sound. The furniture is imported. The wine is aged. The rules are clear. No real names. No outside phones. No cameras. No questions. And above all, no love. I was sipping jasmine tea in a silk robe the color of bruised plum when he knocked. Three soft taps. Not rushed. Not hesitant. Intentional. I set the cup down and stood, letting my bare feet sink into the Moroccan wool rug. I adjusted the belt on my robe, just loose enough to reveal a hint of lace, just tight enough to keep them guessing. Image was everything. Image was survival. Through the peephole, I studied him. Tall. Impeccably dressed. Black tailored suit, not off the rack. Italian leather shoes that had seen polished floors, not pavement. Clean shaven. Hair slicked back with precision. But what unsettled me was not his appearance. It was his stillness. Most men fidget outside my door. They check their breath. Adjust their tie. Stare at the ground like they're about to walk into church for the first time since college. Not him. He stood like he belonged here. Like he'd already been inside. Like he was waiting for me to remember something I didn't know I'd forgotten. I opened the door. Mr. Black, I said, with the same smile I gave all new clients, a smile that felt expensive. He didn't extend his hand, didn't return the smile. He stepped inside without a word and surveyed the room like it offended him. Then, slowly, deliberately, he placed an envelope on the glass table between the velvet armchairs. I don't like to be late, he said, voice low, measured, with just a hint of threat laced into the courtesy. You're not, I replied, motioning toward the sofa. Would you like a drink? He ignored the question, glancing toward the chandelier, then toward the floor-to-ceiling curtains, then the walls. I'd seen that look before, in men who hunted for a living. But he wasn't looking for beauty. He was looking for weakness. I walked to the bar cart and poured myself a glass of red. He didn't ask for one. I didn't offer again. Instead, I sat across from him and waited for the game to begin. Except he didn't speak. He stared. Not at my body, not at my legs, not at the delicate dip between my collarbones. He stared at my eyes, like he was trying to see past them. Like he already had. I've heard about you, he said finally. I leaned back, crossed my legs. Good things, I hope. He smiled, a slow, humorless thing that made the room feel colder. They say you made a senator cry. Only once, I replied smoothly. He liked it. A flicker of something passed through his gaze. Amusement? No. Interest? Not quite. It was more like calculation. I'm not here for that, he said. I don't pay for sex. My eyebrow arched involuntarily. Then why are you here, Mr. Black? He tilted his head, studying me like a specimen. I want you to talk. I blinked. That was new. Talk, I repeated. About what? The other men, he said. The ones who think they're the only ones. The ones you've let inside this fortress. My pulse didn't quicken. My breath didn't change. I'd mastered the art of staying still. But inside, my instincts were screaming. This wasn't a client. This was an informant. A spy. Or worse, a man with something to lose and a plan to make sure I lost first. I reached for my glass, took a sip, kept my voice even. I don't kiss and tell. He chuckled. No, you kiss and conquer. His fingers tapped the envelope lightly, then pushed it toward me. Inside, I already knew, would be something heavier than cash. A photograph. A recording. A threat dressed like a gift. I didn't open it. You think I'm playing both sides, I said. I know you are, he replied. There it was. The drop of venom in the wine. I said nothing, because denial at that moment would sound like guilt. And the truth was I was playing both sides. Senator Hale, Congressman Lorette, bitter political enemies, both of whom paid for my time, my silence, my body. Both of whom had whispered secrets into my mouth like confessions. Both of whom thought I was their private sin. Neither of whom realized the sheets they slept in bore the same scent. Mine. I stood and walked toward the wall-length window. The skyline blinked back at me. Cold. Distant. Beautiful. Just like me. You think I'm disposable? I asked quietly. No, he said behind me. I think you're dangerous. He moved toward the bookshelf. My eyes tracked him through the reflection in the glass. When his fingers landed on the canvas painting above the shelf, an abstract nude rendered in hues of crimson and bone, my chest tightened. He tapped it once. A soft, mechanical click echoed through the room. Not loud, but unmistakable. The sound of a hidden lens adjusting focus. Camera. There shouldn't have been any. And I sure as hell didn't install them. I turned slowly, keeping my expression neutral. He stepped away from the wall and looked me in the eye. How long do you think you've been watched? He asked. I didn't answer. Because now, I wasn't sure. Chapter 2. The Man Who Sees Through Mirrors. They say if you stare into a mirror long enough, it starts to lie to you. Shows you things you want to see. Filters the truth. Conceals the cracks. But the mirrors in my condo don't lie. And right now, I was looking at a version of myself I didn't recognize. She was calm. Too calm. Back straight, lips parted slightly, robe still clinging to her like she hadn't just realized her sanctuary. The one place in the world where power belonged to her had been turned into a stage. A stage she never auditioned for. One she never agreed to perform on. He was still standing by the wall, hands in his pockets like he hadn't just peeled back the skin of my reality. Like he hadn't just told me I was being watched. How long have you known? I asked finally, keeping my tone low. Controlled. My voice had always been my most dangerous weapon. Soft enough to calm, sharp enough to cut. He didn't blink. Long enough. A pause. Long enough to know you're not the one holding the leash. The way he said it, the way those words slid into the air like they belonged there, made something inside me recoil. It was a quiet, cold panic. The kind that doesn't scream or shake or even breathe. It just sits heavy in your chest. I walked toward the painting, reached up, slid my fingers along the back of the frame. There, a tiny bulge in the canvas, embedded perfectly unseen from the front. A camera. My fingertips turned to ice. That wasn't here last week, I whispered. He stepped closer. Not close enough to touch. Just enough to breathe the same air. Do you check often? I didn't answer. Because no, I didn't. Because this place was sacred. Because I paid six figures to make it secure. Because I believed I was invisible behind my velvet curtain of rules and rituals. But belief is the easiest thing to manipulate. He reached into his jacket and pulled out a flash drive. Slim. Silver. Unmarked. Everything recorded from that lens is on here. He placed it gently on the coffee table beside the untouched wine glass I'd poured for myself 20 minutes ago. Back when I still thought I was in control. Who are you? I asked, finally letting the mask slip just enough for the question to sound real. He tilted his head. That same smirk ghosted across his lips. Someone who used to believe in justice. That wasn't an answer. But it was enough to tell me this man didn't come here for sex. He didn't even come here for the truth. He came here to break the illusion. To make me bleed control. I don't take clients who want to play spy, I said, slowly regaining the edge in my voice. I'm not a client, he replied. Not in the way you think. He moved toward the window, staring out at the city like it was his to command. like all those towers and lights and bodies down below were just pieces on a board. I've been following you for 3 weeks. That made me laugh. A low, dangerous sound. Stalking isn't a good look, Mr. Black. Neither is treason. He turned to face me again, and this time, there was something burning behind his eyes. Not lust. Not rage. Purpose. You're in bed with two of the most powerful men in this city, he said. And whether you know it or not, they're both using you. I crossed my arms, the silk of my robe rustling like a whisper. I use them. No, he snapped. You think you use them. That's the difference. His voice echoed in the silence. I hated how steady it was. How damn sure of itself. Like he'd been inside the minds of men longer than I had. Like he'd studied their rot and built a thesis from the mold. They've been surveilling you, he said, documenting every encounter. Every word. Every moan. He let that hang. I don't know how many angles they have. But I know this. When they're ready to burn each other down, they're going to start by tossing your name into the fire. I moved toward the bar and poured myself another glass. My hand didn't shake. Not visibly. They won't, I said quietly. He arched an eyebrow. Why not? Because if they do, I open my mouth, and I don't stop talking. Until the whole fucking city drowns in their secrets. He nodded slowly, as if that was the answer he'd been hoping for, and fearing. And what if I told you they're counting on that? That stopped me. What do you mean? He stepped closer now. Not to intimidate, but to connect. They're not trying to destroy each other. Not yet. They're working together, for now. And you're the fuse. I blinked. That makes no sense. They hate each other. Politically, yes. Publicly, yes. But behind closed doors? They've found common ground. He held up the flash drive. You! I took the glass to my lips. Let the wine stain my mouth like blood. What do you want from me? I asked, finally voicing the question that had been burning from the moment he stepped inside. He looked at me, and for the first time, the steel in his eyes softened, just enough to feel human. I want to know if you're playing the game, or if the game is playing you. We stared at each other for what felt like hours. In that silence, I felt something shift inside me. Not fear. Not anger. Something colder. Resolve. I walked to the bookshelf, pulled a thin, unmarked black binder from behind the first edition novels. Inside were names, bank transfers, voice memos, photos, receipts. I tossed it on the table in front of him. I've been playing them both since day one, I said. And if they think they can use me to destroy each other without consequences, they're going to learn what it feels like to be outmaneuvered. He picked up the binder and flipped through it, his expression unreadable. I believe you, he said. But it's not just about survival anymore. It's about exposure. One of them planted the camera. Maybe both. You need to know who. And soon. Why? I asked. Because I'm not the only one who's coming. And then he left. Just like that. No goodbye. No threat. No touch. He slipped through the door like smoke, leaving behind silence that wasn't velvet anymore. It was static. Charged. I sat alone in the dim light of the chandelier, the wine forgotten, the flash drive cold in my hand. The game had changed. And this time, I didn't know if I was holding the deck or standing in the crosshairs. Chapter 3, Chess Without a King. It's a strange thing, watching yourself on camera. You think you know your own movements, the arch of your back, the way your eyes narrow when you're lying, the way your lips curve into a practiced smirk that men mistake for sincerity. You think you know what you look like when you're performing. But the camera doesn't just record what's real. It reveals what's not. I sat alone on the velvet sofa, the flash drive trembling in my laptop's USB port. A window pulled open with a simple password Mr. Black had left on a folded slip of paper inside the envelope. He knew I'd look. He knew I had to. The first frame flickered on screen. Me walking into the bedroom. Black robe. Bare feet. Holding a crystal glass of something dark, something intoxicating. I watched myself laugh, a soft, rehearsed sound I gave to Congressman Lorette whenever he needed reassurance that he was still the man he pretended to be. The video quality was crisp. Too crisp. High resolution. Multiple angles. This wasn't a cheap job. This was professional surveillance. Discreet. Hidden. Deliberate. And extensive. I clicked through the files. There were hours. Days. Weeks. Time-stamped folders with names I didn't remember giving, positions I didn't remember consenting to. Footage of me. Dressing, undressing, whispering into the ears of powerful men, moaning into silk pillows, smirking into shadows. There were voices. Conversations. audio transcripts, facial close-ups. Someone had been watching everything, not just what I did to them, but how I lived when I was alone, my nightly routines, the way I double-locked the door and ran lavender oil across my collarbone before sleep, the way I stared at the ceiling between clients, wondering if I still had a soul underneath all the silk and strategies. They watched the mask, and they watched when it cracked. I closed the laptop and pressed my hands to my eyes, hard, until I saw stars. Then I stood, walked across the room, and stared at the painting above the bookshelf, now a traitor in a frame. I ripped it off the wall and flung it onto the floor, letting the canvas split against the hardwood like a gutted lie. The lens gleamed up at me like an open eye. I crushed it with my heel. One down. God knows how many to go. The thing about control is that you never really know you've lost it until it's been gone for a while. You walk around thinking you're the puppeteer, when in fact, the strings wrapped around your fingers are pulling you. I made myself a drink, something stronger this time. Whiskey. Neat. My throat burned, but the silence burned more. I needed to know who planted the lens, and I knew where to start. Senator Hale never liked texting. He said it was beneath his position. Everything with him was old school, burner phones, coded voicemails, encrypted email accounts run by assistants who were actually former NSA consultants. His paranoia was biblical, but that's why I trusted him to be consistent. So I called him from the landline. Three rings. Hello. The voice was honey-dipped gravel. Familiar. Patronizing. It's me, I said. He chuckled. You know I prefer when you don't call. I prefer when you don't lie. That quieted him. A beat of silence. Then, what's this about? I need to see you. Another pause. A rustle of something, paper maybe, or nerves. Tonight? Yes. My wife is. I don't care. His breath hitched. You sound different. Do I? You do. I'm not in the mood to be patronized. I'm not in the mood to be threatened. Then we're both in a terrible mood, I said, voice flat. 8 o'clock. Same place. I hung up before he could agree. The hotel suite we used was nothing special. Mid-level luxury. Discreet. Predictable. A place for businessmen to cheat without suspicion and politicians to sink their teeth into whatever soft flesh they weren't getting at home. I arrived 10 minutes early. The concierge gave me the key without a word. I didn't need to show ID. My face was all the validation necessary. When I stepped inside the suite, I scanned the room the way Mr. Black had scanned mine, eyes gliding over vents, paintings, the light fixtures, the molding along the ceiling. It all felt like it was looking back at me now, like nothing in the world was just decoration anymore. I stood near the minibar when Hale entered, loosening his tie like he owned the oxygen in the room. Is this about money? He asked before even greeting me. No, I said. It's about the camera in my bedroom. That stopped him mid-step. He blinked once. Twice. What? You heard me. His jaw tightened. You're being watched? I was. For weeks. He stepped forward, face drawn with practiced concern. You think it was me? I think you and Lorette have more in common than you'd like to admit. Lorette. He actually laughed, a sharp, bitter sound. That sanctimonious child couldn't wire a microphone without getting caught mid-stroke. Then who did? Not me. You sure? He stepped closer, voice lowering. I pay you for discretion. For privacy. You think I'd compromise that by putting a camera in your bedroom? You think I'd let you walk in if I knew it was you? We were toe-to-toe now. The air between us electric. Not with lust. With warning. He ran a hand down his face and muttered, Jesus Christ. You're both being played, I said quieter now. Or playing each other. Either way, I'm in the middle. And I don't like it. He looked up at me. And for the first time, I saw fear behind those tired, predatory eyes. Look, he said, voice tight. There's talk. Whispers. A plan to leak something. I don't know who's behind it. Maybe Lorette. Maybe the media. Maybe you're Mr. Black. He's not mine. But he found the footage, didn't he? Yes. Then he's involved. He said someone's coming for all of us. Hale paled. Then you'd better figure out whose side you're on, before there are no sides left. Back at my condo, I couldn't sleep. I walked through each room barefoot, touching the walls, the vents, the floorboards. I opened every drawer. Every closet. I ran my hands under furniture, inside lampshades, along the baseboards. I found two more cameras. One in the base of my bedside lamp. Another tucked into the smoke detector. Both perfectly hidden. Both wired for sound. Someone had installed them not just to watch me, but to listen. I crushed them both. And then I sat on the edge of my bed, robe open, glass in hand, staring into the mirror across the room. I didn't see a woman. I saw bait, pawn, trap, witness, target, and I realized something. If I was going to survive this, I couldn't keep reacting. I had to start playing again. Only this time, I'd be playing to win. Chapter 4: The Art of Misdirection. There's a myth that predators always know when they've become prey. That the moment the tables turn, some primal instinct kicks in. Pupils dilate, heart rate spikes, hairs rise. That somewhere in their marrow, the hunter can feel the shift, the subtle change in the wind, the hush of silence that means something is about to go terribly, deliciously wrong. But I've learned something in my years of playing Muse to the powerful. Predators don't recognize danger when it's dressed like desire. They don't sense a thing, not when the trap is soft, perfumed, and walking on heels. Not when the bait looks like a woman who's already given them everything they wanted. By the time they realize they're bleeding, the smile on my lips is already painted in their shade of red. And now, I was done being watched. It was my turn to watch them. The rules had changed. But I hadn't. Not yet. 3 hours after finding the third camera, the one hidden in the smoke detector above my bed, angled down like a god surveying sin, I had a plan. Not just a reaction. A calculated, layered response rooted in the one skill that had never failed me. Misdirection. The illusion of surrender. The performance of submission. The distraction before the sting. Everything I needed to burn them both was already in my possession. They'd handed me the fuel willingly. All I needed now was the perfect match. And lucky for me, both of them were already reaching for the lighter. Congressman Lorette was easier to lure. Young, cocky, desperate to assert dominance. He always called me on his second phone. The one with no name assigned to the contact, just a single cherry emoji. The man thought he was discreet because he used burner phones and took cold showers before going home to his wife. But men like him? They confuse paranoia for intelligence. I texted him one sentence. "You're not the only one I've been lying to." His reply came 4 seconds later. "Where are you?" I knew he'd take the bait. His ego was a gaping wound stitched together with ambition and expensive whiskey. I also knew he'd be reckless. He always was when he thought someone else had gotten there first. I gave him a location, a private suite in an unfinished high-rise on the river. The kind of place still wrapped in plastic and silence, built for future billionaires who hadn't earned their fortune yet. I had the keys. Men like me always know how to get keys. He said he'd be there in 30. As for Senator Hale, I didn't text him. I didn't call. Instead, I dropped a gift box at the front desk of his private club. The kind of club with cigar lounges, oil paintings of dead war generals, and female staff trained not to speak unless spoken to. Inside the box was a silk tie. His. And wrapped around it a USB. It contained a single clip, one I pulled from the footage Mr. Black gave me. It showed Lorette and I in bed, skin to skin, his voice whispering something vulgar about Hale. It was clear, crude, irrefutable. There were no instructions, no threats, just the video and the tie, his favorite, the one I had accidentally taken weeks ago and had held on to for this exact moment. I didn't need to say anything. Men like Hale don't respond to accusations. They respond to humiliation. They don't fight to survive. They fight to destroy. When I arrived at the riverfront suite, Lorette was already there. He was pacing, tense, jacket off, tie loosened, sleeves rolled, that air of young entitlement now dripping with suspicion. He turned when I entered, eyes narrowed. "Who is he?" he demanded. I closed the door behind me. "Calm, composed." "Who? Don't play dumb with me, baby," he said, stepping closer. "You sent that text. You knew I'd come. Because you always do." He stopped a foot away, breath shallow. "Tell me who else you've been seeing. You mean besides your mentor?" I asked, tone deliberately cool. His face froze. "I knew it," he muttered, more to himself than to me. "That bastard, he said you were clean. He said you didn't talk. And you believed him?" I laughed, not with amusement, but with pity. "Darling, you were never paying for sex. You were paying for secrets. And now you've run out of both." His hand twitched at his side, not in violence, but in panic. His world was slipping, and I was the floor beneath him. "You're setting me up," he said, voice shaking. "No," I said. "You set yourself up. I'm just rearranging the spotlight." "What do you want?" he spat. "Redemption." "For what?" "For giving men like you the illusion that you're safe." He opened his mouth, probably to insult, to threaten, to plead, but then his phone vibrated. He glanced down, his face drained of color. I didn't need to ask. I already knew. Senator Hale had seen the video. The storm was coming, and I was the one who'd turned the wind. Back at the condo, I changed into something quieter. Black slacks, sleeveless turtleneck, no makeup, hair tied back, a woman stripped of ornament. I needed to be seen, not as a whore, not as a mistress, not even as a threat. I needed to be seen as the architect. And I knew who was watching. I walked to the one place I hadn't checked for surveillance, the mirror in my dressing room. A thick antique thing, mounted against the wall with ornate gold framing. It had come with the condo. I'd always assumed it was just aesthetic. But tonight I saw it differently. I touched the edge, fingers tracing the seam. Then I leaned in, eyes locked onto my own. "If you're watching," I said softly, "I hope you're enjoying the show." And then I smiled. Not the seductive smile. Not the fake one. The real one. The dangerous one. The one I never let them see. An hour later, I got the message. Encrypted. Untraceable. Just three words. "We need to talk." No name. But I knew it was Mr. Black. I texted back. "Where?" "Somewhere public. Safe for both of us." "No such thing." "Then let's make it dangerous." Chapter 5. Truth Without Mercy. The restaurant Mr. Black chose was designed for ghosts. No music. No chatter. Just the low murmur of quiet money and the occasional chime of polished silver against porcelain. Every table was dressed in white linen so crisp it looked ironed by angels, and every corner of the space was wrapped in an atmosphere of reverent tension. Like even laughter would shatter something sacred. It was the kind of place powerful men came to disappear into expensive wine and rarer company. A place where cheating husbands celebrated discreet anniversaries with mistresses who wore wedding rings they'd taken off an hour before. A place where deals were inked not with contracts, but with eye contact, and betrayal was baked into the dessert menu. I wore a black satin blouse with a sharp collar, sleeves rolled just once. High-waisted trousers. Diamond studs. No lipstick. No perfume. Just clean skin and intent. I didn't come to seduce. I came to confront. And he was already there when I arrived. He sat in the corner, back to the wall, facing the room, always watching. Always calculating. A man who studied people like a surgeon studies skin before a scalpel makes the first cut. He didn't stand when I approached. Just nodded at the chair across from him. "Still choosing public places?" I said, sliding in without a smile. "Only when I don't trust the people I'm meeting." I let that sit between us for a second, then leaned in. "We're past the point of subtle threats, Mr. Black." "Good," he replied. "Because I didn't bring any." The waiter came and went in less than a minute. A single wave from Mr. Black was all it took to order two glasses of wine. Red for me, whiskey for him. No menus. No small talk. When the drinks arrived, I didn't touch mine. He did. He took a long, deliberate sip, then set the glass down, folding his hands like he was preparing to read a verdict. "Both men are planning something," he said, eyes locked on mine. "Hale is furious. Lorette is panicking. Neither of them knows what the other is doing, but they both think you are the weapon." "I am," I said flatly. "But you're not in control." I arched an eyebrow. "You keep saying that. But here we are, in a very expensive restaurant, having a very expensive conversation because you needed to talk to me." He didn't flinch. "And here you are meeting me because you needed answers." "Touché." I leaned back. "Tell me something I don't know." He did. "Lorette's chief of staff has been leaking documents. Financial records. Hidden accounts. Bribes." My pulse ticked up. "To who?" "The media. Anonymous sources. One of them has your name attached." I swallowed slowly. "Which document?" "A wire transfer. 50,000. Offshore. From Lorette's private fund to a shell company." "Which connects to?" "A consulting agency that doesn't exist." "Of course it didn't." He reached into his jacket and slid a thin manila envelope across the table. Inside, I knew, would be evidence. More evidence. I didn't open it. "Not yet. You know what this means?" I asked. He nodded. "They're preparing to throw you under the bus. Not as a scandal. As a co-conspirator." My jaw tensed. "They can't," I said. "Not without burying themselves in the process." "Wrong. They'll frame you as the manipulator. The seductress. The puppet master. Men like that don't go down unless they have a scapegoat." "And you?" I asked, voice sharpening. "Where do you fit into this? Why do you care?" He looked at me for a long time. Not blinking. Not breathing. "I had a sister," he said quietly. "She got involved with someone like you." "Like me?" He nodded. "She thought she was playing him. But she wasn't. He used her. Used her body, her silence, her loyalty. When the scandal broke, he erased every trace of himself and left her to bleed in front of the press. My throat tightened. What happened to her? She jumped from a rooftop 4 days after the news broke. Alone. Naked. Headlines said troubled woman. That was it. No trial. No outrage. Just a whisper gone by Monday. I looked down at my wine, finally picking it up. Sipped. It burned more than I expected. You think that's where I'm headed? I asked. I think that's where they want you headed. I looked back up at him. The hate in his voice wasn't for me. It was for every man I'd ever let inside me. Every man I'd ever charged for a fantasy while pretending I was the one cashing in. He hated them, but he feared me, because he knew I was smart enough to survive it and cold enough to finish what they started. I need names, I said. Journalists, editors, whistleblowers. If someone's trying to tie my name to this, I need to know how they're moving. I can get you that, he said. But I need something in return. I smiled. Of course you do. I need access to your files. The ones you don't show anyone. You mean the dirt? I mean the truth. The audio. The footage. The recordings. Everything you've kept as insurance. My fingers curled slightly. He wanted the very thing that gave me power. He wanted leverage. I narrowed my eyes. You expect me to hand you a loaded gun and trust you not to pull the trigger? No, he said. I expect you to aim it with me. We stared at each other. The room buzzed with quiet privilege around us, forks scraping plates, wine glasses clinking, murmured deals whispering across the space. But between us? Stillness. A void filled with everything we hadn't said, everything we knew, and everything we were about to risk. You want to take them down? I asked. I want to burn the whole house. I finished my wine in a single breath. Set the glass down. Then I smiled, slowly, cruelly, like the woman in the mirror had finally come home. Then we start tomorrow. That night, back in my condo, I didn't sleep. I pulled open the drawer beneath my bed, the one hidden behind a false panel, and pulled out 3 external drives. Each one was labeled in code only I could read. Symbols. Numbers. Nothing traceable. I laid them out like weapons. Then I opened the middle one. Video after video. Audio. Text messages. Email headers. Voicemails. Screenshots. Even photos from nights they didn't remember, or pretended not to. I watched myself again. Not for pleasure. Not even for proof. But to remind myself what I was. I was never just a mistress. I was the one thing powerful men never expect. A witness with teeth. And in 48 hours, I'd remind them what it felt like to be on their knees. Chapter 6, The Setup. Everything I'd ever known about survival was born from silence. Not fear. Not force. Silence. The way a man speaks to you when he thinks no one else is listening. The way he touches you when he believes you'll never tell. The way he confesses, not in words but in the fragile calm between sin and sleep, because deep down he doesn't see you as real. Not really. Not someone who will ever hold power. Not someone who will ever matter beyond the moment. But silence is a weapon. And now I was done holding it. I spent the next 36 hours building a narrative. Every war starts with a story. And if you want to destroy an empire, you don't bring down the walls. You rewrite the history. Mr. Black and I worked in tandem, connected by encrypted files, burner phones, and a shared vengeance that never needed to be named. I never asked where he got his resources. He never asked how I had mine. We both understood. The more you know, the more they can use against you. We needed 3 things to execute the plan. 1, a public scandal. 2, a private betrayal. 3, a trigger no one would see coming. And we had them all. I had enough footage to sink both men 1,000 times over. But it wasn't enough to expose them as cheaters or liars. That story would burn bright for a week and then fade behind newer, bloodier headlines. I needed evidence that tied them to crimes, not just sins. And that's where the drives came in. Not the ones I'd already shown Mr. Black. No, these were my insurance drives, the backups of the backups, stored on a hidden server I'd built under a fake identity during my 3rd year in this business, back when I still believed I'd never need to use it. Inside were recordings I'd kept secret even from myself. Hale discussing a hush payment to bury an accusation of assault. Lorette laughing during a phone call about an accidental fire at a lobbying firm that had threatened to expose campaign fraud. Documents signed under fake names. Voice recognition software confirming who said what and when. GPS coordinates. Hotel reservations. Private jet logs. Everything. And most of it was recorded in the very condo I once considered a sanctuary. The irony wasn't lost on me. I staged the scandal like a symphony, one movement at a time. First, I used a false Instagram account to leak a single photo, black and white, grayscale filter. Just a glimpse of Hale's wedding ring sitting on my nightstand. No face, no date, just a caption. He said I was the only one. Within minutes, it was reposted on political subreddits. Within an hour, it had made the rounds on Twitter. Some thought it was AI generated. Others swore it was real. The ambiguity was the point. Because when people don't know what to believe, they start believing everything. Next, I sent a carefully timed email from a dummy address with a deep trail of faked metadata to a journalist who had once tried to expose Hale and failed. Attached were two encrypted files, one with the Hale video, another with Lorette's wire transfers. No names, just timestamps, enough to make them dig. And then I waited. At 2:12 a.m., I got the call. Not from Mr. Black, from Hale. He never called me, ever. He always had an aide do it, always texted a burner and deleted it within seconds. But now, he called directly. "Tell me it's not you," he said. I didn't pretend. "Tell you it's not me. The post. The files. The leak. The F**king firestorm that's about to burn everything I've built." His voice cracked. Just slightly. A man used to orchestrating chaos who now found himself inside it. "I didn't leak anything," I said. And that was true. I hadn't. Not under my real name. Not from my accounts. Not from anything that could be traced back to me. "You think this won't come back to you?" he snapped. "You think Lorette won't drag your name through the F**king dirt to save himself?" "He already has," I replied coldly. "And you helped him." Silence. Then, "I protected you." "No, you used me." Another beat of silence. Then softer. The voice of a man realizing the war was already underway. "What do you want?" I almost laughed. "I don't want anything." And that was the truth. Because the woman who started all of this, the one who wanted power, leverage, control, she didn't exist anymore. She'd been replaced. By someone with nothing to lose. By morning, everything had exploded. Cable news anchors were frothing. Headlines raced each other for the most scandalous phrasing. Senator Hale tied to mistress money laundering scheme. Congressman Lorette faces backlash over affair, fraud links. My favorite one, though, was simpler. The second mistress. Who is she really? Anonymous sources had started speculating. Names were floating, but none of them were mine. The footage was too cropped. The voices too distorted. Mr. Black had made sure of that. It was enough to implicate, but not yet identify. And that's when I made my final move. I invited Lorette to my condo. One last time. He arrived an hour later, pale and twitching, like a man walking into the lion's den hoping the lion was drunk. He said nothing as I let him in. Just brushed past me, jaw clenched. "You need to stop this," he said. "I already have." "Bullshit," he snapped. "It's still spreading. They're digging into my campaign funds. They know about the shell companies. They know about you." I tilted my head. "Do they?" He stepped closer, face flushed. "If I go down, you go with me." I smiled, slow, measured, venom-laced. "No," I said. "You go down because of me." His face crumpled into rage, but before he could speak, I clicked the remote in my hand. The TV screen on the wall came to life. Footage played. Not of him. Of me. In my bedroom. Alone. Crying. Talking to myself. Rehearsing lines. Repeating phrases men had said to me in the dark. My voice raw. Shaking. Human. He watched frozen as the camera panned across the room. As the mirror across from my bed flickered. As the hidden lens inside revealed itself in the reflection. "What's this?" he asked, voice cracking. "Proof," I said. "That you were watching me." I didn't install anything." "But you knew," I cut in. "You knew and said nothing. You used the footage to control me. To silence me." "I save it." I clicked again. Footage shifted. Now him, entering the condo 3 weeks ago. Drunk. Loud. Saying Hale's name. Talking about his campaign. His secrets. All caught on tape. "I'm going to destroy you," he said, voice low, broken. I stepped forward. "No," I whispered. "I already have." Later that night, alone in the condo, I walked to the mirror in the dressing room. The last one. The only one I hadn't checked. I stared at it for a long time. Then I reached up and pulled it off the wall. The lens behind it blinked red. Live. Watching. Recording. I leaned in, close enough to kiss the camera, and whispered, "Watch this." And then I smashed it. Chapter 7. The Collapse and the Crown. There's a moment, right before something falls, when the world holds its breath. A silence not born of peace, but of anticipation. Like the universe knows gravity is about to claim what doesn't belong standing. That was the moment I lived for. Not the fall. Not the impact. The breathless hush before it. The split second when everything still looked intact, but wasn't. And now, that moment belonged to me. I wasn't the second mistress anymore. I was the woman pulling the strings as the kingdom collapsed. And I was ready to watch them fall. By 7 a.m., Hale had issued a statement through a trembling press secretary who could barely read it aloud. The senator categorically denied any wrongdoing, citing doctored footage, deepfakes, and a targeted campaign of political sabotage. But the evidence was too heavy, too real. The journalists weren't backing off. Too many sources had started talking. The financial documents I leaked were now in the hands of an independent oversight committee. A subpoena had been issued for Hale's private email servers, a second for Lorette's campaign financials. By noon, every major news outlet had the story plastered across their front pages. The footage had gone viral, spliced, edited, and subtitled by thousands of viewers hungry for blood. TikTokers reenacted scenes from the bedroom tapes, lips mouthing my moans. Reddit threads speculated on my identity with fervor usually reserved for serial killers and pop stars. The second mistress. Some people thought I was an actress. Others a political plant. A few thought I didn't even exist. That I was AI, a character generated by both sides to destroy each other. That was the beauty of the lie. No one could prove I was real. And that meant I could choose who I became next. I stood before the mirror again. Not the one that had hidden the last camera I'd shattered that days ago. This one was new. Smaller. Framed in plain black. Hung above my vanity like a placeholder for a version of myself I hadn't yet become. I stared at my reflection, taking stock. The damage was there, subtle but visible. Eyes a little darker. Jaw a little sharper. Shoulders tighter, like I was still bracing for another blow. There was no victory in this. Only clarity. No one walks through fire and comes out untouched. But I hadn't burned. I had learned. Mr. Black met me one final time in the same shadowy restaurant where this war had first been declared. This time, the staff didn't smile when they saw me. They whispered. They watched. They didn't know my name. But they knew. And that was enough. He sat at the same corner table. Same drink. Same eyes that saw too much. He didn't ask how I was. He knew better. Instead, he placed a folder on the table. The rest of the story, he said. I opened it. Photos. Bank accounts. Private chat logs. Lorette post-scandal, trying to arrange a deal to buy silence from a known media fixer. Hale, offering a quiet settlement to one of the women he once called irrelevant. Screenshots of backroom conversations where they plotted my disappearance. Not metaphorically. Literally. Kidnapping. Deportation. A car accident staged in a tunnel. They were going to erase me. And now, they couldn't even find me. Your work, I asked. He nodded once. I closed the folder and slid it back to him. No, I said. Our work. He leaned back. You've made enemies. I was never safe to begin with. They'll come for you eventually. I smiled faintly. Then I'll be waiting. He raised his glass and I raised mine. No toast. No promises. Just a mutual understanding. We had both killed kings. And now the throne sat empty. 3 weeks later, Hale resigned. He claimed health issues. Stress. A need to focus on family. His wife left him 2 days after the announcement. His lawyer released a vague threat about suing those responsible. But it never made it past the headlines. Because once a man like Hale falls, no one scrambles to catch him. Lorette held out longer. He tried to survive the storm, leaning on youth, charisma, the appearance of innocence. But innocence doesn't sell in the face of wire transfers and footage of him weeping after sex, begging a woman for loyalty he'd never offered himself. His resignation came via Instagram Live, a desperate, poorly lit video where he sobbed about betrayal and cancel culture. I watched it twice, then deleted it. I sold the condo, burned the furniture, replaced everything, even the walls. I needed a new silence, one no man had touched. I moved into a small flat overseas, a city where no one asked questions and no one recognized my face. My real name was still safe, and the woman I used to be, she was gone. Replaced by a myth, a ghost, a shadow. They still talk about the second mistress on the internet. Podcasts speculate that she was a spy, a political assassin, a pawn gone rogue. Some even think she was an angel of vengeance, created to take down corruption. They romanticize her, demonize her, turn her into something bigger than flesh. But she was real. I was real. I am. And I'm still watching. Still listening. Still waiting for the next name to whisper into my mirror. Because power doesn't disappear. It only changes hands. And this time, it's in mine.